Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Initiative on Cities, Department of History, Department of Political Science, and the College of Arts and Sciences Academic Enhancement Fund. Our speaker is Rutgers University Newark Professor Stephen Diner. Professor Diner will be speaking on universities and their cities, urban higher education in America. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Boston University Professor Virginia Sapiro.
So I was really excited when I happened to stumble across the fact that a book is coming out that University Professor Stephen Diner of Rutgers University Newark is writing on universities and their cities. And I thought, what better way, very selfishly, to learn more about this than to bring him in before any of you have had a chance to read his book. And so he'll be here talking on that project. Stephen Diner is a historian, and after earning his degree, his PhD at the University of Chicago, he started out his career in the University of the District of Columbia, an important urban institution in Washington, D.C., where he became the chair of the Department of Urban Studies. He then moved to George Mason, where he began getting more and more involved in higher ed administration, and eventually moved to Rutgers Newark as Dean of Arts and Sciences, and eventually became its long-term chancellor. He says, and his website shows, that that the relationship between that institution and its community and the issues that are most important to urban communities were those things that he really focused on, and takes great pride in the way that Rutgers Newark stands out as being one of the premier institutions of higher learning in this country, known for its diversity and the relationship between its programs of education and diversity. He has always been interested in that. He's written on that as a scholar, and he also acted on that as a university leader. So without saying any more, let me turn it over to you. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Gina. I must say that I'm really impressed that Gina contacted me and asked me to come and talk about a book that wasn't yet published and that she hadn't read. Hopefully she didn't make a big mistake. That's very iffy. But it was very flattering to me to have Gina contact me simply based on Johns Hopkins Press advertisement about this forthcoming book. So let me begin by talking about how I got interested in urban universities. I did my PhD at the University of Chicago, and I wrote my doctoral dissertation on the role of professors at the University of Chicago in progressive era reform in the city of Chicago. So, and wrote about some very well-known people like Charles Merriam and Edith Abbott and Sophonisba Breckinridge, and all kinds of very important scholars who were very connected to the city and for whom the city of Chicago was a stimulus for the development of academic research. And again, this was just at the beginning of the development of the research university in America. You know, University of Chicago is one of the early ones. Okay, so that's initially how I got interested in this. But then I taught, as Gina said, at the University District of Columbia. It was about as urban as you get. And I was at George Mason, which was a suburban institution. But then, for 16 years, I held administrative job, and then the last 3 years, faculty, at Rutgers University Newark. And when I interviewed for my position at Rutgers Newark, I said, largely based on the research I had done on Chicago, oh, well, there are tremendous opportunities to build the quality of this institution, the teaching experiences, research, if we take advantage of the city of Newark. And at the time, some people thought that was great. Some people thought I was out of my mind. Newark, this terrible, declining city. How can you say that anything good for the university can come out of that? But anyhow, that's what I did for 16 years. And as I was winding down mentally, I said, well, I don't know how much longer I'm going to be chancellor. But when I finish, I really want to write a history of urban universities. And so, lo and behold, I finished, and I had a year off, and I started work, and then I took another year off and finished the book. And so it'll be out shortly. Let me suggest, first of all, the overall theme of the book is how anti-urbanism has prevailed in American higher education until very recently. This opposition to colleges and universities and cities and anxiety about cities is very, very profound. Scholars of American higher education, one in particular, Frederick Rudolph, talked about the emergence of what they call the collegiate ideal. College was a place where students would come, would live together in a community, would engage with each other, and be close to nature and close to trees and all of that. So there was deep, deep reservation about having higher education institutions in cities. A classic case was a minister, Charles Thwing, with a deep interest in higher education, decided to, and he later became a college president, he decided to write a book on American colleges. And his third chapter was entitled Morals. And he said that a significant number of city-bred college students, quote, are immoral on their entering college, because the city environment has, for many of them, been excellent preparatory schools for sophomoric dissipation, and even home influences have failed to outweigh the evil attractions of the gambling table and its accessories. In contrast, students from rural settings have been deeply elevated by not only the purity of the student's home, but the associations of his country life, and said that the higher rates of immorality among students in colleges located in or near cities reflects the character and surroundings of the colleges. So, this is a classic instance, but he wrote this in, I can't remember. Early 20th century. Late 19th century. 1883 was when he wrote this. And this is a nice synthesis or summary, so to speak, of the view, the dominant view, that college was a place to build character in young men. The founders of this institution, Boston University. Initially, it was, some of you probably know this, a divinity school. And it was to be located in New England, in rural New England, in New Hampshire and Vermont and various places. And then at some point, they moved to this area, but they didn't want to come to Boston. They wanted to go to Brookline, which was the countryside at that point. But for various reasons, it didn't work out. Just some examples. When people have said to me, if there was so much anti-urbanism, what about all of the colleges that were built in cities. You know, how do you explain Columbia, Penn, et cetera, et cetera? Well, Columbia, originally King's College, started in 1754 on Lower Broadway. And it moved three times till it reached Morningside Heights. And when they came to Morningside Heights, they kept moving because they said, you can't have a college near all these urban things going on. So when they moved to Morningside Heights, by then they realized that sooner or later the city would catch up with them. So they decided to build a walled campus with lots of trees planted on the campus and figured that will protect the students and enable us to build character in young men. A similar story with the University of Pennsylvania. They moved several times till they got to what's now the current location. And, you know, again, trying to escape the city. One of the more interesting examples is NYU. Now, NYU was something of a working, not exactly working class, but, you know, a school that was not highly selective and had programs for people who lived and worked around, you know, Manhattan, lower Manhattan. But they decided around 1890 that they really needed a really good quality liberal arts college. And they couldn't possibly build a good quality liberal arts college in the middle of the city. That was the thinking. So they purchased land in the countryside, now called the Bronx, and they built this amazing campus with Gothic architecture, walls, overlooking the Hudson River to build, you know, character in young men. And then, of course, over time, the Bronx changes. And then finally, in the early 1970s, they sold the campus and consolidated everything in the city. One of the interesting things, I want to go back to this institution, to BU for a moment, as those of you who are here probably know, the covers of many BU publications quoted Longfellow. And the quote was, "Where should the scholar live? In solitude or in society? In the green stillness of the country, where he can hear the heart of nature beat, or in the dark gray town, where he can hear and feel the throbbing beat of men? I will make answer for him and say, in the dark gray town." Now, you can interpret this as an embrace of the city, and on one level, it is. But this is 1869 or so. But my reading of it is it's an apology for the city. You know, since we have to be in the city, and the city is considered a dubious place, so let's say something good about it and hope that people will believe it. The land-grant universities are also another interesting example. When Congress passes the land-grant institution, legislation provides funds to establish such institutions. Virtually every land-grant university was built in the countryside. There are only two and a half quasi-exceptions. University of Minnesota did build the campus in Minneapolis, but again, on the edge of the city. Ohio State also built, there was a huge debate about should it be in the city or how far and so on. They built it on the periphery of the city. And then Massachusetts, of course, the primary land-grant institution was the Agricultural College in Amherst. But MIT maneuvered to get part of that land grant money for engineering to their institution, which at the time was relatively new, and so they manipulated, so to speak. Now I should add that starting in the 1870s and 80s, the modern research university emerged in America. And the most classic examples are Clark University in Worcester, University of Chicago, and in Chicago, obviously, and Johns Hopkins University. And when those institutions were established, the founders deliberately placed them in cities because they saw the cities were very important to what they wanted to do. But, and here's the important but, they were primarily interested in graduate and professional education. And the consensus, so to speak, among educators was, yeah, you can have graduate programs and professional programs in cities. You know, if you're going to train lawyers or doctors, that's where you have the hospitals and the courts and so on. So, yes, they did open in cities, but their primary focus was on graduate study and advanced research. Now, one other entity that was very important were what were called municipal colleges. And municipal colleges were colleges started by cities, often extensions of public school systems. The very first municipal college in America was the College of Charleston, which was actually founded as a private institution, but was taken over by the city of Charleston in 1837. But more to the point, in 1847, the Free Academy of New York, now known as City College, was established. And in 1871, the Female Normal School in New York, now Hunter College, was established. So there were obviously these local sort of commuter institutions that were growing up, and I'll say more about that in a moment. And then, of course, there were Catholic colleges. Since the Catholic population was overwhelmingly in cities, there was some urgency on the part of Catholic leaders to locate institutions, or some of them, in cities. So St. John's University was opened in 1871 in Brooklyn, Canisius College in Buffalo in 1870, St. Ignatius College, now the University of San Francisco, actually 1859, Loyola of Chicago, 1872. So there were, there are many others. Now, one of the results of this attitude, about location, was an extraordinary negative view of urban college students. Frankly, I had no idea that this was the case until I began my research in the records of the Association of Urban Universities, which began in 1914. And as I went through their annual proceedings, all of this, I was kind of stunned. So let me try to give you a couple of examples. The dean of Tufts University in 1917 wrote the following. He said, although students who came to Tufts, quote, in the early days came from rustic families, they had a background and ideals very different from those students who come to us today. They are naturally people without background, referring to the students today, are naturally people without background, and they lack imagination. Therefore, although they can apprehend a fact perfectly well, they have nothing at home, and I fear very little in the schools to prepare them for actual literary work. So that's Charles Fay. A similar quote from about the same time from Kenneth Mason, who was the dean of freshmen at Brown University. And he said he worried that his institution, quote, in common with other institutions located in a like environment, has in her student body too large a proportion of socially undesirable students. Emphatically denying that he was Jew-baiting, which he was, but denying that he was Jew-baiting, he expressed concern about, quote, the influx of alien blood into what was not so long ago a homogeneous group of students, prevailingly Baptist and Anglo-Saxon. The social background and breeding of many students, he continued, are such as to make their college training of little value to society. A person, George Schuster, who became president of Hunter College in 1939, wrote after the fact that he said when he assumed the leadership of the college, quote, a large number of the girls who came to Hunter had absorbed a variety of prejudices from home environments, displayed only the rudiments of good manners, spoke English atrociously, and had as little use for honor societies as they did for Herbert Hoover. He then described these students, mostly daughters of Jewish immigrants, as, quote, raucous, gawky, and afflicted with acne, halitosis, and deplorable hairdos. And he said faculty believed that Hunter should teach students to, quote, become socially and morally the kind of women who are deserving of a Hunter degree. This meant teaching them a sense of honor and public service, including charm and courtesy. So, you know, this theme just keeps getting repeated by leaders in higher education. And then on top of that, there was a particular concern, even more than commuter students, about adult students and continuing education students. And many of these leaders said, oh, you can't educate these adults, and what do they think they're going to be educated? And how can they possibly, learn? They come part time. They go. They work. They're working class. This became an issue. Now, interestingly, in 1965, this institution established a continuing ed center called Metro Center. And, this was very characteristic of what universities and cities were doing, but it was also subject to a good deal of criticism. Now, this is not just yesterday. it was yesterday, but it also appears much more recently. In the 60s and 70s, 1960s and 70s, many writers about higher education or professors expressed deep concern about the lack of preparation, sophistication, training of minority students who were now coming to higher education in much greater numbers. So, for example, in 1967, David Riesman, the eminent sociologist, wrote that commuter students go home to their uncomprehending families and their non-college friends, where they are surrounded by people who think liberal education is merely another kind of trade school. And another example, a man named Thomas Harrington, who wrote a book about working with student personnel work in colleges in 1974. And he says, among other things, urban commuter students find it difficult to understand the new behaviors expected of them or to meet the faculty's expectations for self-direction. Moreover, they must still relate daily with their siblings and parents who may have no tolerance for newer values that they learn in college that might conflict with the family's social, religious, and political views. This is a theme that appears over and over again. And, of course, in more recent years, it's probably focused more on black students and what is thought to be cultural deprivation. And coming from homes where they haven't built up the sophistication needed to do college. Now, another theme that I look at, and it's not unrelated to this, is what does it mean to be an urban university? When I started this work, I thought it was pretty obvious. An urban university was a university in a city that connected in some ways to the opportunities in the city. But then I discovered that from the founding of the Association of Urban Universities in 1914 onward, there's been a continuing argument by educators as to what constitutes an urban university and what makes a university urban. Almost everyone began to say location in the city is not enough. It's not just because you're located in the city. Some people argued you got to use the city for teaching. Some people said you got to use the city for research. Some people said you have to have close ties with the city and its neighborhood. And this is the interesting one. Many people said to be an urban university, you have to serve a majority of students who come from the city in which you're located. Okay? And one of the results of this ongoing discussion is that by the 1960s and 70s, urban university came to be a pejorative term. It meant a university of commuters, low-income students, poorly prepared students, etc. This is not in my book, but I'll tell you one story. In 1983, I was at the University District of Columbia. I interviewed for what was called American Council on Education Fellowship in Academic Administration. This is something where, if you're foolish enough to think you want to do university administration, you spend a year interning with the president of another institution. I was interviewed for this, and one of my interviewers was the provost of American University. And at the end of my interview, he greeted me very warmly, said, "You have a really impressive record. You're going to have a fine career ahead of yourself in urban universities." And he started ticking off any number of schools with large minority enrollments. And I said, "Oh, or American University." He said, "Oh, no, we're not an urban university." I.e., we're not low status, we don't educate those, and in some ways I think he was saying, "You're a white guy who can deal with blacks," because I'm coming from a black institution. And I think that's what he meant. One of the continuing issues that universities and cities have faced is how do they relate to the needs of city government? And one of the things they do very early on is create training programs for city employees, which culminates in the establishment of public administration as a discipline. They also develop early on training programs for public school teachers, which ultimately results in normal schools, and then they're called education schools. Some institutions began internships and community service programs. In 1904, for example, the University of Cincinnati started the first cooperative education program in the country. You know, and that was the vision of its president. So there, not every institution did this by any means, but there was a strong inclination toward giving students that kind of internship experience going way back, you know. And then there's the issue of urban research. Essentially, universities and cities were certainly the place where scholars began studying urban life and related issues. In 1958, the Social Science Research Council created a committee on urbanization, and that's sort of a marker that now urban studies, urban research was becoming mainstream. In 1967, the HUD commissioned the National Academy of Sciences to report on the status of urban research and how it could be used to address urban problems. This is, of course, at the height of what's known as the urban crisis. But it also established, in conjunction with the National League of Cities, something called urban observatories. The urban observatories were intended to be city-by-city, university-based entities that would study the local problems of their community and try to research them and therefore find solutions to them. And this program went on from 1968 till 1974. In 1974, Congress said, well, it's been so successful that they can raise local money for it and we don't need any more federal money. And then almost all of these pretty much collapsed. But another dimension of this is that shortly thereafter, there began a movement to create urban grant universities. One thing urban educators were constantly talking about was, look at what the land grant universities did for agriculture. Well, agriculture was the problem of the 19th century. But the problem of the 20th century is cities and urban life. And so we should have urban grant universities, universities that get federal money to address the problems of cities. And this idea has gone on until about 3 or 4 years ago, when I think they finally gave up. I was involved when I was president of the Coalition of Urban and Metropolitan Universities. I was involved in actually lobbying to get, I think they called it the Urban Renaissance Bill, you know, passed by Congress. And actually, various pieces of legislation were passed but never funded. But the idea was, shouldn't the government devote substantial support to universities in cities in the way that it did building the land-grant institutions? And, you know, urban universities constantly use this analogy, but nothing really ever came of it. Okay, another theme that I talk about in the book is neighborhood relations and urban renewal. Obviously a big, big issue. As universities and cities grew and expanded, increasingly they found themselves in some kind of tension with the neighbors who lived around them, and in particular those that were in lower income neighborhoods, because the idea was, well, we ought to kick out the poor people, the black people, and, you know, otherwise no one's going to come to our institution. As early as 1957, the Association of American Universities began a study of the impact of low-income people and neighborhood deterioration on universities and cities, you know, which is a clear indication of the concern that they had. In 1959, 2 years later, the American Council on Education, which is sort of the umbrella organization for all of higher ed, set up a special committee on urban renewal. Also in 1959, the U.S. Housing Act provided substantial federal money for universities if it was spent on land acquisition, construction, demolition, and relocation. In other words, in this thrust to create urban renewal, they saw, well, universities and cities are a major entity. Let's give them the money to upgrade their neighborhoods and upgrade the cities, and wouldn't this be a good thing? And a whole bunch of institutions were involved in this. The first involved in sort of neighborhood change, revitalization, whatever you want to call it, was the Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago because of its location in South Chicago, and it was one of the earliest institutions to find itself in a black neighborhood. So they did a bunch of things there. University of Chicago is a famous case, deeply involved in transforming Hyde Park. Columbia, and all kinds of student protests and the like around Columbia. Penn, several institutions in Cleveland created something called University Circle, which was a mechanism to transform the neighborhood and keep it safe for higher ed. Fordham University, Temple, I could go on and on, but there were numerous cases, and this continues to this day. It's a very real issue for urban universities, or universities in cities. Finally, there was a considerable debate in the post-World War II era, and certainly by the 60s, considerable debate within higher education about what was the proper role of universities in addressing these urban issues. I did a check of the New York Times. I found that before 1966, there were almost no articles that used the term urban university. Just after 66, numerous examples, numerous cases. The Metro Center of this distinguished institution had a conference and then published a report in 1967. And it was his third annual conference of the BU Metro Center, and it was devoted to university and community action. And in the report, it says, most university faculty members are sympathetic to the cause of minority groups, but are not sure that universities, including urban universities, should get into community action in a direct way. Instead, they should undertake independent, uncommitted research and teaching. Others, some within higher ed, many outside of higher ed, mayors and the like, all saying universities have failed to address the problems of cities. Here they are in cities. They should be doing much more. And that argument goes on as well. One last dimension that I talk about in the book. One of the reflections of anti-urbanism is the resistance that flagship state universities showed to the development of urban state universities. This is a huge case. You know a lot about UMass Boston. Yeah. Berkeley, for example, there was pressure from Los Angeles to create a branch campus of the University of California down there. And Berkeley resisted, and then the legislature ultimately forced it on UCLA. And initially, the head of the UCLA campus would be a provost reporting to the president of Berkeley and so on. And eventually, they created the modern system. But this was a huge battle, and Berkeley did not want to see a campus in UCLA. UMass Boston is a classic case. Administration and the faculty at UMass Amherst were categorically opposed to building anything other than a modest extension or maybe undergraduate school in Boston. The idea of building a serious research university in Boston seemed to them crazy. Why would anyone want to go there? Why drain the resources? We better have one good university. And I must say, a number of the private universities in Boston, for other reasons, you know, reasons of competition, also resisted. But ultimately, UMass Boston was built and has become, you know, obviously a major and comprehensive university. Another instance of this, if you've ever wondered why Indianapolis has a university called IUPUI, Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. Well, the reason is that in the 60s, the mayor of Indianapolis started complaining that the state higher education system did not have a major institution in the largest city in the state. Seeing what was happening elsewhere, the administration of Indiana University and Purdue University, they're both public, got together and said, why don't we announce the create a research university in that city which will report to us and not be independent of us? And that's how we got IUPUI. That was their tactic. University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, had all kinds of struggles with Madison over, you know, the establishment of another competing institution in Milwaukee. Probably one of the most interesting cases is University of Illinois, Chicago. The University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana had a rapidly growing enrollment, and there was more and more demand, in the 60s for a place where students could go to college, state university. And so against Champaign-Urbana's will, a decision emerged that, well, we're going to have to do something in the Chicago area. But then UIC and others said, well, yeah, but it should be in the remote suburbs, because who in their right mind would want to go to college right in the middle of Chicago? And there was continuing argument about this. And then Richard Daley, the mayor, who was incredibly powerful, prevailed. And he said, I want it, and I want it on the edge of downtown Chicago. And that's where it was built. And today, I think it's considered one of the leading public urban universities in the country, with a deep commitment to urban research and the like. But it was this huge fight. Then there's Rutgers University, my own institution. And there was Rutgers has had a peculiar structure in that, unlike, you know, the sort of university systems elsewhere, where there's a CEO of each campus and then they report to a president or a chancellor, Rutgers, Newark, and also Rutgers and Camden, the head of the campus reported to the head of the New Brunswick campus, which is the way most of these other places were originally, but New Jersey never changed. There was a proposal a number of years ago to merge the medical university. New Jersey had a separate medical university, a University of Medicine and Dentistry, and its largest campus was in Newark, a few blocks from the Rutgers campus. And then it had a slightly more prestigious medical school in New Brunswick. And so there was a proposal by a leading scientist to merge the Newark entities, merge the New Brunswick entities, and there was also something in Camden. And the president of Rutgers was unalterably opposed to merging anything but the New Brunswick Medical School into Rutgers. He did not want to see the Newark or the Camden. And I was chancellor. I went out very aggressively pushing for this because I thought, you know, one great university in Newark. And I was removed from office for that reason. So, anyhow, having said all this, things definitely have changed in the last 20 years or so. For one thing, I think the nation's view of cities has changed, and cities have revitalized. Some would say it's a bad thing because you're kicking out poor people. Some would say it's a good thing because now you have middle-class people living in the cities. But whatever the reason, there's no question cities in America, some more than others, you know, have revitalized in significant ways. And interestingly, more and more applicants to college are now applying to universities in cities. And the small liberal arts colleges in rural areas and small towns are really suffering in terms of applicants. The students don't want to go there. And there are a variety of reasons for this, but experiential learning has become very mainstream in America, and students like the idea of being actually able to go out to a law firm or an art center or a museum or what have you and learn firsthand. And that's becoming increasingly popular, and you can do that so much more easily and so much more thoroughly in a city than a rural area. And I think also college students are looking now. They're worried about getting jobs when they graduate. And so they're much more oriented toward, well, what experiences can I have in college that might lead to a job? You know, if you're in a city and you're working, you know, doing an internship someplace, that might lead to a job or give you the kind of network that you wouldn't have had otherwise. So I think we've had a major reversal. You know, after all this history of anti-urbanism in higher education, I think in the last 20 years or so, it's changed very significantly. And now cities are considered very attractive. They're also very attractive in terms of recruiting faculty. faculty of all kinds, but particularly faculty couples. Because, again, if you're going to Champaign-Urbana and one spouse does whatever, can't find it, you know, there aren't all that many jobs there. That would make it difficult to recruit, whereas if you recruit someone in a city, almost certainly a spouse can find some kind of work, you know, some kind of professional opportunities in that city. So my conclusion in all of this is that universities in cities have ultimately, despite the anti-urbanism, have had a profound impact in shaping higher education today. And I point to a number of dimensions. One, the what we call the democratization of higher education, making higher education accessible to students of a wide variety of backgrounds, including low-income, minority, immigrant students. This began and was built by universities and cities years and years ago. Likewise, the enrollment of immigrant students, minority students, again, while that may be a national trend and an important, is now viewed, diversity is now seen as a major way to judge the quality of an institution. Again, it began with institutions and cities. Nowadays, experiential education is very mainstream. All institutions, or most of higher education, talks about the real value of experiential education, as well as the importance of building a sense of civic responsibility on the part of college students through encouraging community service. So this campus compact, which is, encourages that. And there's also a whole movement for engagement research, encouraging faculty to do the kind of research that engages with the communities. And then, of course, urban studies is a main field in the social sciences and in other disciplines as well. And I'd argue that all of those things, which are systematic in higher education today, in all institutions, they are things that began in urban institutions at a time when higher education in cities was viewed skeptically. Okay, I hope I didn't talk too long.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture by Rutgers University Newark professor Stephen Diner. Professor Diner spoke on universities and their cities, urban higher education in America. His lecture was presented by the Boston University Initiative on Cities, Department of History, Department of Political Science, and the College of Arts and Sciences Academic Enhancement Fund. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Professor Virginia Sapiro. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Ian McCarn. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.